This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 17th, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Aura Bogado. As the U.S. Senate works on immigration legislation, immigrants' rights advocates rally outside the Capitol. The United Auto Workers Union votes to strike after Delphi moves to cut jobs, pay, and benefits. And the University of Colorado Boulder releases the results of its investigation into Ward Churchill. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The United Nations Security Council has unanimously approved a measure to begin preparing for a UN-led peacekeeping mission in Sudan's Darfur region. Sudan signed a peace agreement with Darfur's largest rebel group on May 5th. The AU has given the other two rebel groups until the end of the month to sign on or face sanctions. The Ugandan government and authorities in southern Sudan have agreed to hold peace talks with the brutal Lord's Resistance Army rebels, Joshua Chilimba reports.
A statement released from State House in Kampala says the LRA rebels have been given until July to peacefully end their terrorist activities, or the Ugandan government and its ally, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, will launch joint operations against them. President Museveni made the latest peace offer after meeting the British Overseas Development Minister Harold Bain in Kampala. The president said the rebel leader Joseph Kony and his top commanders, indicted by the International Criminal Court, would be guaranteed safety if they take up the latest peace offer. The LRA is listed as a terrorist organization by the U.S. government. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
In Houston, the jury has begun deliberations in the Enron trial. Lisa Cohen reports from the courthouse.
After 56 days and 54 witnesses, including preachers, convicted government cooperators, and Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, testimony in the Enron trial has ended, and the case has gone to the jury. Lead prosecutor Sean Berkowitz gave the government reply this morning, saying that the decision whether or not Enron's practices were business as usual or crime was a question of credibility. Berkowitz reviewed the testimony and corroborating emails and documents introduced during the trial and pointed out again how they differed with the message that Lay and Skilling gave their employees and shareholders right up until the bankruptcy in December of 2001. Lay and Skilling took care of themselves, he said, with massive stock sales in the tens of millions while obscuring from public view their knowledge that Enron was collapsing. He asked the jury to send Lay and Skilling a message that you can't buy justice, you have to earn it. Lay and Skilling each face maximum life sentences if convicted on all counts, and Ken Lay's bank fraud trial, a separate matter, starts tomorrow. From KPFT, I'm Lisa Cohen for Free Speech Radio News.
A lawsuit has been filed in Los Angeles against the Coca-Cola company, alleging the glass bottles of imported Mexican Coca-Cola contain dangerous levels of lead in the painted labels. KPFK's Kelly Barnes reports.
California's attorney general and the city attorney who filed the suit say that consumers have not been warned about the presence of toxic chemicals in the bottles, which constitutes a violation of the state's Proposition 65. The prosecutors say lead is so toxic, even ingesting minuscule amounts can be hazardous to human health. PepsiCo settled a similar lawsuit last month by agreeing to phase out bottles with lead-painted labels within the next 10 years. PepsiCo will also pay a $1 million fine, attorney's fees, and cover the costs of surveillance to ensure that Mexican Pepsi bottles are not sent to California. Coca-Cola says the refillable bottle from Mexico was never authorized for sale in California, and that all bottles being manufactured today for Coca-Cola from Mexico are 100% lead-free. A statement released by Coca-Cola today quotes a toxicologist and a founding member of the Proposition 65 Science Advisory Board as saying that many residents of Los Angeles drink tap water with higher levels of lead. I'm Kelly Barnes for FSRN in Los Angeles.
A two-day meeting of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change closed in Bonn, Germany yesterday, reflecting the ongoing controversy on how nations should best respond to climate change. FSRN's Allison Benjamin reports.
A non-binding two-day dialogue between 189 nations on how to combat global warming wrapped up in Bonn, Germany yesterday. Controversy marred the talks as the chair of the meeting, Canadian Environment Minister Rona Ambrose, was criticized for her government's anti-Kyoto stance. Canada said last week that it could not meet its commitments under Kyoto, an announcement that was criticized by environmentalists and by German Environment Minister Sigmar Gabriel. In Canadian Parliament yesterday, opposition parties passed a non-binding bill demanding the government live up to its Kyoto commitments. During the bond talks, U.S. climate negotiator Harlan Watson announced that Canada, Japan, China, India, Australia, and South Korea are interested in a U.S.-led pact called the Asia-Pacific Partnership on Clean Development and Climate. The partnership would involve voluntary emissions cutting measures and green technology sharing to combat global warming. Monday and Tuesday's bond talks were a precursor to negotiations that begin today on how to extend Kyoto past 2012. For FSRN in Vancouver, I'm Allison Benjamin.
Bolivia's Minister of Agriculture has presented a six-point plan to reform land distribution. Dileta Varlese reports.
The set of land reforms announced yesterday by Bolivia's Minister of Agriculture, Hugo Salvatierra, and Vice President Alvaro Garcia Linera will entail the redistribution of between 2 and 4.5 million of hectares of unused lands. The lands will be confiscated from large landowners and handed to small farmers. In addition to land redistribution, the reforms will also combat the ongoing practice of slavery. Although slavery is illegal in Bolivia, it still occurs in isolated areas controlled by large landowners. President Evo Morales is expected to sign the set of reforms as early as today. For FSRN, Diletta Varlese, in La Paz, Bolivia.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Senate is considering a series of votes that would move the compromise immigration legislation it's currently considering closer to the draconian House proposals that provoked mass demonstrations earlier this month. Immigrant rights advocates are rallying outside the U.S. Capitol in protest. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Senators are adding amendments to the immigration legislation that will shape it to their liking. Republican Senator John Cornyn from Texas.
It shouldn't be any surprise to anyone that that the bill is going to continue to move toward the center. I think the original bill, McCain-Kennedy, was about as far to the left as it could be. But I think it's part of a strategy, and I don't begrudge the strategy because everyone understands that where this bill will be written will be in the conference committee between the House and the Senate.
Senator Cornyn and fellow Republican John Kyle from Arizona got their amendment passed through the Senate. It would disqualify any immigrant convicted of a felony, who has missed immigration court dates, or who has violated their visa from obtaining legal status. This provision held up the immigration bill last month because Democrats thought this would disqualify all undocumented immigrants currently in the U.S. and would mean mass deportations. But after much wrangling, the amendment has included the so-called humanitarian provisions that would give waivers to immigrants who have settled families in the U.S., for example. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina.
Break people into groups based on what they did and their individual circumstances. And to me, that has to be part of immigration reform. One size does not fit all.
The revised amendment is expected to deport about 800,000 people. The Senate agreed to it unanimously. The Senate also agreed to build a 370-mile fence along the southern border. A telling provision that did fail would have stripped any path to permanent legalization. While the debate under the Capitol dome continues, immigrants prepare to rally outside to put pressure on the Senate to include full legalization of all undocumented immigrants. Juan José Gutierrez is a leader of the May 1st coalition.
Some people in the Senate, some people in the House are going to argue that this bill needs to get toughened up vis-a-vis border enforcement, making it more difficult for the undocumented to become legalized and eventually naturalized. We will also be able to achieve some sort of arrangement that truly benefits the best interest of all the millions of people that are full of expectation, waiting for the Congress of the United States to act and give them the type of immigration reform to get some legalized out of the margins of society and fully integrated into the mainstream so that they can have a normal life.
The coalition was formed to oppose the House immigration legislation, H.R. 4437, which would make felons of undocumented immigrants. The president's political advisor, Karl Rove, visited House Republicans this morning to urge them to support a comprehensive bill. But many in the Republican Party stand by the House bill. House Majority Leader John Boehner.
The Senate has to move a bill. The House has already passed its bill. And if the Senate moves a bill, we get in a conference. I don't underestimate the difficulty in coming to an agreement, but that's where the negotiation will occur.
But members of the House Hispanic Caucus have reservations about the Hagel-Martinez legislation in the Senate that divides immigrants into three groups, depending upon the amount of time they have resided in the U.S. Representative Luis Gutierrez from Illinois.
We believe our caucus is on that position that they should all be treated the same.
The Senate will continue to vote on amendments throughout the week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld says there is no timetable for withdrawing troops from Iraq. He made the remarks while giving testimony on the Department of Defense budget this morning before a Senate subcommittee. Darby Hickey reports from Capitol Hill, where protesters disrupted that hearing, as well as another one on Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Are we still going to see a significant troop withdrawal this year?
Senator,
I know that question surprised you, Mr. Secretary.
No, indeed it didn't. Needless to say, we would hope so.
Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, minced no words in his questioning of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld about the future of U.S. involvement in Iraq. Leahy and other members of the Senate Appropriations Defense Subcommittee peppered the Secretary and head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, with questions about stationing National Guard troops at the Mexican border, the Iraq War, and specific weapons programs. The proposed 2007 budget for the Defense Department is $460 billion, and the administration has requested a supplemental $46 billion for war costs in Afghanistan and Iraq. On the other side of Capitol Hill, Congressman John Murtha, Pennsylvania Democrat, again pushed his resolution for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq.
Now, those who disagree with me, and even a fourth-grade class the other day, they said, what do you do? What happens if we leave? Well, what happens if we leave today? What happens if we left 6 months ago? They have to settle this themselves. There's no plan to make things better, and so it's time for us to leave, to redeploy. And I say that in Iraq, success of Iraq is up to the Iraqis. The Iraqis must settle their differences, and we must set a timetable for the Iraqis to take complete control of their country.
Representative Murtha's resolution has not moved since it was introduced 6 months ago, but Republican opposition is not the only obstacle. Nancy Hill, a peace activist with the group Code Pink, says Democrats are not doing enough to stop the war.
We feel that they are not listening as well. That is why we have to be here for a month talking to everyone we possibly can and getting our voices heard however we can, because our feeling is that most people who are in power and are supposedly representing us are not representing us.
Nancy Hill, who came to D.C. from Tucson, Arizona, to spend the month lobbying Congress and opposing war, interrupted Secretary Rumsfeld during his testimony before the Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, calling him a liar. Other Code Pink activists also disrupted a Senate hearing today on Iran's nuclear programs. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
A New York court of appeals has rejected a lawsuit seeking to give prisoners the right to vote, but the court did express interest in how counting inmates who can't vote towards the population totals in rural counties where they're incarcerated creates extra Republican seats in the legislature. The lead plaintiff, Joseph Hayden, argued the current laws were created to dilute the voting power of African Americans. If that practice changes, it could give Democrats a majority in New York State Senate. Rebecca Miles has more.
Juan Cartagena, general counsel of the Community Service Society, which represents Hayden, said the opinion came down 8-5 against the plaintiffs.
Residents of these communities, and these communities are over-concentrated with a large number of individuals with felony convictions, we allege their collective voting strength is also diluted because their collective voting strength is impacted severely by these laws that take away the right to vote from their brothers, sisters, neighbors, friends, etc., who live in their very same communities. The court ruled that that claim also would not be reached by the Voting Rights Act. But in saying that, it then raised the specter of, is it possible for the Voting Rights Act to have a dilution claim, that is the weight, the collective weight of the vote of blacks and Latinos in New York City? Could that be diminished illegally under the Voting Rights Act? Because of the separate proposition that individuals who are in prison in upstate prisons are counted as residents of those communities and not as residents of their home communities. Would that decision to count them that way for the purpose of creating representational districts create a separate violation of the Voting Rights Act? And that is the issue that is going to be studied soon.
What the inquiry does is illuminate a quirk in the federal census. States generally use census data to reapportion legislative and congressional districts. Eric Hecker, a partner with Emery, Chelle, Brinkerhoff and Abbotty, who filed a similar lawsuit over the constitutionality of population disparity, says the constitutional challenge hasn't occurred before, but it well might with this court's latest opinion. But
New York is demographically a Democratic state, and were the state Senate districts fairly drawn, the state Senate would be in Democratic hands, not Republican hands. And the reason why the state Senate is controlled by the Republicans is because the districts are gerrymandered on a partisan basis. And for sure, one reason why the Republicans would be reluctant to change the prisoner counting rules is because they know, as do the Democrats, that if the rules were changed and the prisoners were counted where they lived as opposed to where they housed, the districts would have to be redrawn and the Republicans would lose their gerrymandered demographic advantage.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
Members of the United Auto Workers Union voted overwhelmingly this week to authorize a strike at parts manufacturer Delphi. They're protesting the company's proposal to emerge from bankruptcy by cutting positions, pay, and benefits for its U.S. workers. Max Pringle reports.
A strike could bring North American production at Delphi's 21 manufacturing facilities to a halt. It could also shut down production at Delphi's former parent company, General Motors. The United Auto Workers represents about 24,000 Delphi workers across the country. The union said 95% of union voters chose to approve the strike. In March, Delphi filed court papers seeking a court order to dissolve its contracts with the UAW and other unions after it was unable to win concessions from them. Delphi's bankruptcy case will restart later this month. Gary Chasen is professor of labor relations at Clark University in Massachusetts. He said the UAW is turning up the pressure in its negotiations with Delphi.
I think the strike vote by the United Automobile Workers is really ratcheting up the pressure on Delphi. Delphi has made a threat that it will have its collective agreements with the UAW rejected by the bankruptcy court. And the UAW is also showing that it's willing to play hardball as well by having a strike vote among the membership.
Lindsay Williams is the corporate affairs manager at Delphi's world headquarters in Troy, Michigan. He said the company could no longer compete given its high labor costs.
We're battling to become competitive with U.S.-based competitors that have, in many cases, unionized workforces, and in some cases, unionized by the same unions who represent our employees. So our focus is getting a consensual deal, but it's also becoming competitive in the long run.
Some unionized Delphi workers said General Motors spun off its Delphi parts division to dump those wages and benefits. Greg Shotwell manufactures fuel injectors at a Delphi plant in Saginaw, Michigan, and is a UAW member. He said corporate managers misspent funds meant for wages and benefits and led GM and Delphi to the dire financial straits they're now in.
While a worker is actively working, that money is supposed to be set aside for his pension and put into a trust to cover health care costs. They didn't do that. You know, 20 years ago, when you bought a General Motors car, you paid for that person's pension and that person's projected health care. Where did the money go? General Motors spent it. They either gave it out in dividends, bonuses to executives, or they invested that overseas. They did not invest in the United States.
Delphi filed for bankruptcy last October. The company plans to close 21 of 29 U.S. union plants. Delphi also proposed cutting its U.S. hourly wages from $27 an hour to as low as $12.50 an hour if GM doesn't help pay those wages. It also expects to lay off thousands of salaried workers and up to 40% of corporate officers, as well as shutting down over 20 international plants. Professor Gary Chasen said the UAW had no choice but to reject concessions and stand up for its members' jobs.
I don't see how the UAW's membership could have accepted the proposal that was put on the bargaining table by Delphi, because essentially it would have had a drastic cut in wages and a drastic cut in jobs along with that. It's not as if they had been asked to cut wages to save jobs. They were being told that not only would they lose their wages, but would also be losing their jobs.
Observers have said that Delphi began to lose profitability after it split off from General Motors and entered the low-cost auto parts manufacturing sector, still burdened with high-cost union wage, benefit, and pension contracts inherited from GM. The automaker is still Delphi's largest customer and has agreed to help fund early retirement buyouts to 13,000 UAW Delphi workers and to reabsorb 5,000 more. Members of the International Union of Electrical Workers, which represents about 8,500 Delphi workers, have already voted to authorize a strike. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in Berkeley.
Violence spilled out onto the streets of Kathmandu this week, the first time since King Gyanendra restored power to the nation's parliament. It's been 2.5 weeks since the Nepali parliament started convening in the wake of a popular uprising against the king. Many are starting to worry that the slow pace of progress since then may jeopardize the nation's stability. Carrie Byron reports from Kathmandu.
Although intermittent demonstrations have taken place in recent weeks here in the capital, the latest escalation comes after a, quote, historic proclamation had been scheduled to take place in the parliament on Tuesday. Official releases had only suggested that the announcement would reassert the House of Representatives' supremacy in the country after King Gyanendra was forced from power in late April. Rampant public conjecture, meanwhile, has assumed that several definitive changes were in the making. These have included name changes for both the Kingdom of Nepal and the Royal Nepalese Army that would strip references to the monarchy while also cutting many of the king's powers. On Monday, however, the political leadership in Kathmandu announced that the proclamation would be postponed. Simmering tensions over the already slow pace of reforms subsequently exploded out onto the streets on Tuesday.
We are trying to protest. We are trying to make aware to government on current issues such as establish people's power first, then go ahead.
That's Yogris Limbu, a protester with an indigenous rights group. He and hundreds of others are standing immediately in front of the parliament building, closing down one of the largest intersections in the capital.
Many Nepali people fight for this, no? But government is not working as our expectation. Because yesterday there was one news, this parliament is going to announce, but it was stopped. We are thinking that the reason that conspiracy started.
Conspiracy is a word that has often been repeated in recent days here, including by people for whom English is a third or fourth language. Shobhakar Budatuki, a human rights worker, says that most of these conspiracies revolve around the monarchy and the army.
There are so many conspiracy theories to go throughout the country. Therefore, people have a feeling of fear of the political parties. Hear that they might compromise with the monarchy and the military, so they do not want to happen there, so they're cussing the political parties.
Throughout the day yesterday, thousands took part in simultaneous demonstrations throughout the Kathmandu Valley, and five government vehicles were reportedly torched. A few blocks down from the capital, more demonstrators are burning tires in the middle of another intersection, towards which Prakash Sindolia, a student, is walking.
And I also agree with the protesters because I have heard that one of the leaders of ours is being the king's S-man, and he's trying to do what the king is telling.
As Sindolia notes, much of the ignition for the current violence was still unsubstantiated rumors that Sher Duba, a former prime minister and leader of a large political party, had been partially responsible for the official proclamation's delay. Although Duba has repeatedly denied the accusations, many believe that he had been advocating for King Gyanendra to remain in control of the army.
Yeah, that's the most important, because army is the manpower of the country. But if king is not allowed to use army, if he has not power of army, then how can it be possible for him to use the army and exploit us?
In this, the first real violence to take place in Kathmandu since the three-week strike in April, roles have been uncomfortably reversed. Although many of the same people are still on the streets, the political leaders are no longer among them. While the royal government had consistently blamed the specter of Maoist insurgents, the new democratic government is now blaming the current violence on anarchists. Urging calm yesterday, the Home Minister promised the crowds that the proclamation would be tabled at 3 p.m. on Thursday. Demonstrators said they would remain on the streets until that time. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Carrie Byron in Kathmandu.
Well, now this is Utah Phillips, and I'm down here in Albuquerque, and I listen to Free Speech Radio News because I need to know the truth, and I can't get it from the top down. I get it from the people who are on the street, like the gentleman I'm talking to right now.
The University of Colorado in Boulder has released its report on the investigation into ethnic studies professor Ward Churchill. Churchill has drawn fire for remarks he made about September 11th. The university is investigating charges of plagiarism and academic misconduct. The controversy has sparked debate about the tenure system, but critics say the investigation is an attempt to quell free speech on campus. Maeve Conran reports.
The committee's investigation of these allegations found unanimously, by a preponderance of the evidence, that Professor Churchill committed several forms of academic misconduct as defined in the policy statements of the University of Colorado at Boulder and the University of Colorado system.
Marion Wesson, professor of law at CU Boulder and chair of the investigative committee, presented the 124-page report yesterday afternoon at CU. The report is a result of 4 months of investigating the academic work of Ward Churchill and found several cases of plagiarism and academic misconduct. The committee recommended sanctions against Churchill, although final decision on sanctions will be made by the university provost and the dean of arts and sciences. In its report, the committee questioned the timing behind the decision to initiate the investigation. Last year, Churchill became the subject of national scrutiny, following an essay he wrote on 9/11, in which he compared some of those who died in the World Trade Center to Adolf Eichmann, the Nazi bureaucrat. Committee Chair Marion Wesson.
These essays played no part in our deliberations, but we do express our concern regarding the timing and perhaps the motives for the university's decision to forward the charges that were made in that context.
Barry Hartman, spokesman for CU, reiterated the university's position that the investigation had nothing to do with Churchill's controversial writings, but rather the controversy was a catalyst for the other complaints.
9/11 occurred. Ward Churchill is writing essays about 9/11, and his essays became public. Suddenly, Ward Churchill became a national figure. So people out there who may have had complaints about Ward Churchill in the past suddenly said, it's time to question this guy's scholarship. So the university began to receive complaints. And when we receive complaints under the rules, those complaints have to be passed on to the standing committee.
Following the release of yesterday's report, Ward Churchill issued a statement saying that the investigation has been a pretext to punish him for engaging in constitutionally protected speech and to discredit the alternative historical perspective that he represents. He says that he will contest each finding of misconduct. Last week, Churchill's wife and fellow ethnic studies professor Natsu Saito submitted her resignation to CU, citing the university's treatment of Ward Churchill and the ethnic studies department amongst her reasons for departure. Since early 2005, the Ethnic Studies Department has received thousands of racist and threatening emails and phone calls, which Saito says the university failed to respond adequately to. Professor Saito is also a tenured professor of law at the University of Atlanta in Georgia. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maeve Conran.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Rousseau and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines producer. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can find archives of our newscasts and documentaries online at www.fsrn.org. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Auto Bogato.